This Friday edition has two parts. Our first feature story is about the Arcata Playhouse. They recently taught shadow puppeteering at the Hoopa Elementary School. The Arcata Playhouse also operates an internet radio station, Humboldt Hot Air. We'll hear that story too. Part two of the edition, we share an audio story from station WBUR Boston and carried by the Lost Coast Outpost website, posted by Andrew Goff, four young condors reintroduced to their ancestral skies. We start with the Playhouse.
I am Jackie Dandino, and I am the executive artistic director. Currently, we have 15 employees, including our artists and schools teacher, but probably really about 7.5 full-time. So we have a lot of part-time employees. We have a core team of 8 people who do the day-to-day operations around the Playhouse, and most of them are a little over half-time, and some of them are full-time. We work for $3 and a goat most of the time, so we're not highly paid, but we do have a lot of support from the community, and we have a lot of awesome people on staff. So,
How long has the Playhouse been going?
This is our 16th year. We started when my daughter was not a year old yet, so that's easy for me to keep track of because she's 16 this year. So she basically grew up in the Playhouse. Both of my daughters grew up there.
So. Wow, what an opportunity. You always live in a playhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, cool. They sometimes thought that, and sometimes they were like, I don't want to sleep on the couch tonight in the lobby. Can we get a babysitter so I could be home in bed? So it comes and goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you want to hear about the Arcata Playhouse?
Sure. Tell me about the Arcata Playhouse. Where are you located and all that type of stuff?
The Arcata Playhouse is located at 1251 9th Street. That's 9th and L in Arcata. It's in the heart of the Creamery building. In the Creamery district, it's the tallest building in Arcata. And it's right off the bike path. And we're on the dark side of the Creamery. So we're on the east side of the Creamery. I think it's east. Maybe it's north. Kitty corner to Haleashi. And we have a multitude of programs. We have an artists in schools program where we send teaching arts out to schools. We have we're producing right now the Family Fun Series, which is a series of free events for families in a huge circus tent that we just bought and we're putting up on 8th Street. We also do music programming. We also do rentals, so you can rent the Playhouse. We also do art installations, and we do a thing called Art on the Fence, and then we've also had some other art installations that we've done about town, and some street mandalas and street painting. We also do a program called Skuyech Sanina in conjunction with the Yurok Wellness Coalition, which is what we're in Hoopa to do. So Hoopa is one of the schools. We picked 6 schools to do the program in. We come to the schools and we do it free of charge. So we back end it through other funding, this time with the Department of Health and Human Services. Hopefully more funding will be coming in from other places. And it is in conjunction with the Wellness Coalition and their opioid program. So how we can talk about help-seeking behaviors and respect and talk about things with little kids, second and third graders, is what we're working with in Hoopa. There are 92 second and third graders in Hoopa, which is the largest school that we've done thus far. And they, we have Ernie Albers Jr. comes in and tells the story. And then we have Vincent Felice from NCIDC comes in and does some talk with them before we actually begin working with puppets with them. So that Vincent talks about from a more social psychologist angle. So he's a social worker and he talks with the kids about emotions and how we process things and how we, you know, how they could talk about how they're feeling and how they could ask people for help. And then Ernie and his son Caleb come and tell the story. And then we do a little shadow puppet demo. And then we work really intensely with the kids for 2 weeks, Monday through Friday, an hour every day, and they build a shadow show. And so tonight, Friday, March 25th at 6 o'clock, the kids are going to do the shadow play for the community. And it's going to be, they're really excited about it. We're also going to have a dinner before the show. And then after the show, there'll be snacks and things for the parents and the kids to talk about what they did and talk about how they felt. We talk a lot about how their puppets feel and how they feel and, you know, the little bird asking for help. It's a really great program. It's really, the kids are really awesome here in Hoopa. They're so into it and willing and creative and they're full of spunk and, you know, they're not all sitting in a line with their hands in their laps, and that's awesome as well. They're just really great kids who have a lot of life in them. And so that's really exciting to be working with them, and challenging too when you have 92 of them. So that's that. That's Skooyetch. And then the other program that we have that's really exciting is Humboldt Hot Air. And that's an internet radio station that we run out of the Playhouse. And then I'm going to stop talking and let Narrily fill that in, because that's the program that she runs. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hear about Hot Air.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Narrily, and I also work for the Arcata Playhouse, and my main role is to run Humboldt Hot Air, which is the Arcata Playhouse Arts new, fairly new. We've been broadcasting, streaming, I should say, for about 6 months now. We're called Humboldt Hot Air. We stream right out of the Arcata Playhouse. You can find us online at humboldthotair.org. And we have mostly just a really wide variety of music programming right now, with a little bit of talk scattered in there, but we're streaming every day except for Tuesdays, and really still growing our wings and figuring out who we are and what we're doing. But it's been really fun, and we're still, I mean, you know, if this is, you're listening to this and you live in Arcata and you want to get involved, we still have open slots, which is really fun. So I'm getting to continue to offer it as a resource to people who are interested in programming. Really, something that I love about Humboldt Hot Air is that there's no experience necessary. I love being able to just, anyone who's interested and has a passion for radio and has always wanted to, but never had the resources or the right connections to get involved. I'm really excited to offer it to people like that. So yeah, my email is humboldthotair@arcadaplayhouse.org, and we can make something happen. Yeah, it's been fun.
And how many staff are you working with? How many Hot Air people are there?
We have kind of a lot. We've really been filling up our schedule, and we're at about 50. So yeah. And people are kind of coming and going, you know, but that's how it goes. And we seem to still have a lot of interest of people reaching out to me and wanting to program with us.
That's amazing. I'd like to give a plug to Narrily, because when Narrily came on, we weren't really on the air yet. And we had sort of, with the demise of KHSU and the local programming on KHSU, we had struggled to figure a way to make Humboldt Hot Air work. And Narrily just really jumped in with both feet and learned on the ground and on the fly and figured things out. And the fact that having just started really last summer, that we have this many DJs, there's an app, you can get an app. It's like, I'm just full of admiration for what Narrily's done there and how she's run it. So it's like got nowhere to go but up. So
thank you.
Good job,
Narrily.
I'm surprised if you have 50 people, you're not operating on Tuesdays.
I know. the Tuesday thing was something I set out with from the beginning, because like I said, we're still really growing and figuring things out. And part of that is that we're still training people and we only have one room. So our whole thing is in one room, about the size of the room we're sitting in right now. So it's hard for me to not have a day where I can get people in there and train them and change things around. Sometimes the equipment needs something, I need to mess with it, or I need to just be in the room. So that is why for now I can't have people programming all the time. I'm considering maybe sticking some people in the evening on Tuesdays, because I'm not usually there. I don't necessarily need the whole whole day free. But yeah, that's the reasoning behind No Tuesdays for now.
So every shift, it's live?
Yeah, everything is live. Yeah.
Because we only have, we've got maybe two volunteers. One time when we started, in, we had enough people to run maybe about 12 hours a day. And then we got to a bind where we had no money at all. So everybody was volunteering, including myself. And we had, and I was trying to do everything, and I was getting pretty tired. So I start doing these canned PSAs where I actually talk into a coffee can and pretend like I was a robot. And I have control of all of you here. And so I come on, so get, don't save us from Auto Man. And then I play Jefferson Airplane's Volunteers of America. Volunteers of America. Come on down and volunteer. And it worked. Got 22 people.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we had live programming 7 days a week, 15 hours a day.
Nice. And that's great.
Yeah. And then when we went to CPB, getting to their funding, then you had to up it to 18 hours a day. And that was a bind. Oh, my goodness. We struggled with that, but we made it.
No, I think it's good. More volunteers.
Yeah, yeah, that's also kind of what I was saying before. Of part of what's nice about the internet radio is that we also don't follow as many rules. So the training process of getting new people on air is a lot simpler because I don't need to teach them about all the many things that you're not allowed to do when you're broadcasting as an FM station. Mm-hmm. So most of my training just doing internet stuff is how do you use the equipment? And we have some guidelines around content and things like that, but it's nothing compared to what you have to do when you train someone to become a DJ, on your station, I'm sure.
Yeah. One of the tricks is the timing at the top of the hour. You got to give the call signs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And some people can pull it off.
Yes, I remember it well. So the radio experience I have before this was KZSC, which is the radio station on the UC Santa Cruz campus. And that's where I worked for 4 years. So I do know all of those, those things. And I
I try to train people to do is getting close to an hour, at the top of the hour, you've only got 2 minutes, don't play a 6 minute song.
Yeah.
And then if you do play something, at least make it an instrumental so then you can fade it down.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, the math of radio.
Yeah.
2 minutes to go, 6 minute song. That means it...
You do have a 10 minute window though, don't you?
Oh, well, yeah. We try to tighten it up 2 minutes before or 2 minutes after.
Oh, okay.
So we
gotcha,
had a 5 minute window.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's a fun game. I really enjoy it. And after talking with you and meeting with you in that other chat and or the other Zoom meetings we had, I thought, internet radio. People had asked me, well, what are you going to do, internet radio? And I said, well, no, I don't want to do it. But then after meeting you and listening to you, I thought, okay, maybe I might consider that if I don't have to follow FCC rules, I don't have to broadcast every day.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe I'll just – you ever hear the Audubon Society, they have bird notes. It's a two-minute program. It's daily. So they give you a whole month of – every day, 5 days a week. That's material they'll pump out. And it's birds. One bird. They'll feature one bird in that show. And they'll so you hear it, and then they'll tell you about that bird. And so I thought, I got a stack of these Audubon CDs. What if I just put them all on one track and then edit out all of the intros? So you don't hear any of the intros. You don't hear that. This is bird notes talking to you. I do a little Audubon. Get all that out and just play the content.
Yeah. And that sounds great.
And then I could put that on whenever I don't have anything to broadcast a program, just put that on. People could tune it in and hear bird notes.
Oh, that's
just
great.
Like do a live feed from your, from the parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I thought would be fun. It's just like, a live feed, like an overnight feed of this is the parking lot of the playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear anything, and maybe you hear someone walking or sleeping, or I don't know.
That would be funny.
Ambient sounds.
We have one of our DJs does live performances, James Zeller. He does live performances. And the other day he did live from outside the playhouse. He brought them. He connected a bunch of mic cables all together and brought it outside so nice. he could be streaming from outside. And he was doing that as people walked past. He was like, hey, you want to say hi? And people were coming over and it was cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
You should be able to do things remotely too with internet radio. You should be able to get something that would be a Bluetooth.
You can really easily, because remember we did the didn't feel very remote, but it was when we did it from the theater. We streamed the Christmas show on Humboldt Hot Air, and it's very easy. You just download the same software, which we're using is called Audio Hijack. You just download it onto a different computer, so a laptop, and then disconnect the stream on the Humboldt Hot on the studio end and reconnect it on a different computer, and there you go. So
there
it's pretty
go.
Easy. Yeah. Especially in a theater where we just plugged it into the soundboard that's in the theater.
Nice.
We
took feeds off people's cell phones.
Yeah.
And just put the microphone next to the cell phone and just let it go.
I know. It's funny. Sometimes we have so much fancy technology, and then when it comes down to one of our DJs the other day was like couldn't figure out how to get the phone call on the, and then he just like held his phone up to the mic, and it honestly sounded like on speakerphone, it sounded totally fine. You could clearly understand all of it. And I was like, yeah, it works.
Well, ever since the pandemic, and people have been doing things like that.
Mm-hmm, and
so
totally.
So the audio quality, people got used to it.
Yeah.
Anything goes now.
Anything goes now. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
I think that where you are at, located, used to be the New World Ballet.
It used to be the Pacific Arts Center.
Pacific Arts
Center. New World Ballet was around the corner. Maybe New World was the Dance Center, and New World Ballet are now Redwood Rocks. And we were the Pacific Arts Center in the 70s for maybe the early 80s for 10 or 12 years.
Okay.
We're also the Zen Meditation Center was in the playhouse, as well as a roller skating rink. And at one point, there was a go-kart track.
Wow.
And a creamery.
All at one time.
All at one time. Jam them all in. People meditating, roller skating around, cars.
Yeah. Milking cows.
Milking cows.
And don't forget the goat.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's been a lot of things. It's been a big community center. And, you know, our landlords, Brian and Lisa, always had a vision for the Creamery building that it would be an arts center. And they're really philanthropic. And without them, we wouldn't be there. They really subsidize our rent and a lot of artist rent in the building, and really believe in that vision that it could be a place of arts. So that, you know, there's us, the playhouse, there's a dance, Redwood Rocks dancing, there's potters, there's photographers, Greg Moore and Bandemonium are in the back, James Hildebrandt is in the back, the pottery store is around the corner, Noel Munn, who's done pottery, Phoenix Pottery forever, there's a jeweler, it's just full, rife with artists, they're just crawling out of the woodwork. And so it's really a testament to them and their vision for that building that, you know, that we all get to be there and do it.
That's
and hopefully it won't gentrify and kick us out.
Right. That's like the Ink People.
It is, yeah. I worked for the Ink People for 10 years with Libby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I she was my mentor from, I was doing a business degree at CR. I did a beginning business degree with an overview of accounting and management, sort of started interning with Libby, and then I just kept working there for 10 years and then eventually had to quit because I had too much of a job at the Playhouse to actually work at the Ink People too.
Yeah.
Libby's awesome. Yep. Leslie Castellano is the new ED. She's awesome as well. Yeah, it's a great organization. It does a lot of good, a lot of good in this community. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Art is one of the pillars of society.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. If you want to squash something, squash the artists.
Right.
Yeah.
Monstrous effect.
Exactly. Arts and culture. Where you go then.
Yeah, right. A room full of artists. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you again.
Let's work Let's work something out.
Yeah, definitely.
We can work it out.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks.
After the story of local media art, we turn to a story of the Yurok tribe's 14-year project to reintroduce the condor to our West Coast skies.
California condors. Imagine them soaring for miles without even flapping their enormous wings. Sadly, Native American tribes have long had to use their imaginations. Condors were wiped out from their ancestral territory by the early 20th century. But after decades of research and outreach, the Yurok tribe is set to reintroduce the critically endangered birds back to Northern California skies. This spring, they say, the condor will soar again. Tiana Williams-Clausen is the director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department. Hi, Tiana.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me here today.
So we're talking about four young condors raised in captivity that will be released in Redwood National and State Parks. Can you tell me about how complicated this process has been of getting them to this point of release?
If I had all day, I could tell you how complicated it's been. But we actually started this process as a tribal government officially in 2008 and went through years of habitat analyses, partnership buildings, particularly with Redwood National and State Parks, who's one of our strongest partners there in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, enacting legislation, community outreach, and finally culminating through our environmental assessment process, which wrapped up in 2021 with that final approval to bring condors home. And since then, we have just been running ragged for the last year.
So we say four young condors. How young are they?
Two of the birds will be about 3 years old upon release, and two of them will be about 2 years old. So they're fully flight capable. They've never yet been out in the wild, though. So they're particularly unique in that we'll be releasing these juveniles into a relatively empty space, which is a little bit different than other places that California condors are being released, where they have established flocks by this point.
In years past, before condors were endangered, they had a huge range all the way from Baja, California, up into Canada. How far do you expect your condors to travel?
The thing about releasing the young birds is we're very much hoping for management reasons that they'll stick relatively close to home, at least for the first few years. And given that, as I mentioned, they don't have a flock to integrate into, they'll be kind of scoping out this area and re-identifying places that condors historically used. So probably not too far in the first few years, but once they're established, a condor can fly as much as 100 miles per day around its established territory, or 200 miles per day if it's trying to get from point A to point B. And there have been geospatial analyses conducted in coordination with a collection of traditional knowledge that show that we expect condors to start expanding northward, kind of along the coast and in the mountain ranges, and maybe down even into the Sierras to the east and the south as well, but perhaps wrapping up all the way into the Columbia Gorge and heading east from there and up into Washington. So we kind of consider this to be the gateway for re-expansion into the Pacific Northwest.
All this work is personal to you, as I understand. Not only are you a member of the Yurok tribe, but you earned a degree at Harvard and then came back to work on condor reintroduction. This has been your project. Have you imagined the moment when those birds are finally arrive and are released?
It seems almost unreal, despite the fact that we'll be receiving our first birds in really just a couple, 3 weeks. What keeps striking me is when I'm driving along the highway, for example, through the mountain ways or along the coast, along the canyons, and I'll see a turkey vulture in the air, or even I'll just be imagining it and I can just see a condor flying through what I know their ancestral home is here. So really what I'm envisioning is that moment when they're just a part of our life again, and I could at any point just look up and see them in the sky.
I'm imagining chills. That's incredible.
Yes, it has literally been my life's work. I went to work for the tribe immediately after I graduated from college. I've since then, you know, been here for 14 years. I started as a technician. I've moved to a biologist, then the director of the wildlife department, which has grown exponentially since then. I've had a child who loves condors in a way that I never loved condors growing up, just because they'd been gone so long. I didn't have that relationship with them that is so important to our tribal people. But she's always going to have that relationship. She already loves condors. She's already asking for Prigg Hanish. That's the Yurok word. She's asking for YouTube videos of Prigg Hanish. because she loves him so well. And that just makes my heart incredibly happy.
So you interviewed a tribal elder and ceremonial leader named Dr. Walt Lara Sr. about the condor. He sang a song for you that has passed down through the generations. I want to listen to just a little bit of it, and then maybe you can tell me about it. So, Tiana, what is the song about?
Well, the song relates to one of our most foundational relationships with Condor and our foundational reason for being as Yurok people. And not only Yurok people, but all the tribes in this area consider themselves to be world renewal or fix the earth people. We consider it to be our fundamental reason for being. And so Condor features very heavily in our world renewal ceremonies. And that goes back to the beginning of time, before humans were even really the people of the world, when the animals were the people of the world, the spirits of the world. The creator at that time knew how important it would be to maintain a world balance, to raise up a people who knew what that meant. And so he started devising these world renewal ceremonies. And he looked around and he said to everybody, well, we're going to do this dance. It's going to be one of the most important things that we do and that we teach the humans. I need a song. Or in our other words, I need a prayer, because our songs are our prayers, to help lead this dance. And so he in particular looked to Preganish, to California Condor, because he flew all over the world and he could see all of the things of the world because he had a kind and generous heart. Mm. And so it's that song that we sing in our world renewal ceremonies today.
And you also asked this tribal elder, Walt, to describe the stories he had been told about condors when they were still around, which was a long time ago. Here's a little bit of that.
They stood on the beaches. They'd all stand around on the beaches, you know. Then when the wind would come up, they'd just raise their wings up and twist the tips up a little bit, and they'd just pick right up and fly off. They wouldn't fly. They'd coast off. They'd glide.
What did you learn from Walt, maybe that you didn't know before, about the relationship with condors?
That story comes from before even Walt was born, because the last time condors were really documented in our area was at the turn into the 20th century. So about 1892 is the last documented bird in our area. But those stories are carried on from elder to elder, from elder to young person. And it's just so awesome, because you've kind of got this idea of Western science, which of course is an incredible tool for identifying some of these locations and needs and the like. But this is on the ground information that's been passed down for generations now about how condors engaged in our world.
I assume that the hope is not only that these four young condors thrive, but that they mate, that the condors become yet again permanent residents of the tribe's area.
The birds themselves don't reach full maturity till about 6 to 8 years old, so it'll be a few years yet. Uh-huh. But in the meantime, we will actually be adding about 6 birds per year. Honestly, for the next 20 years is the plan.
Wow.
This first cohort is super important. They are going to be the leaders of everybody who comes after.
So for those listeners who are not a member of the Yurok tribe and perhaps don't have any kind of ancestral relationship with this bird, what can you tell us about why this is important, the broader implications of finally being able to release condors back to a land that where they used to live and thrive?
From a conservation standpoint, this is a really big step towards reestablishing them. So reestablishing redundancy, reestablishing resiliency, giving them better protection against climate change, giving them new landscapes to expand out into and new relationships to form with people. There's been a ton of local and regional, national and even international interest in what we're doing and love for what we're doing. And I'm just incredibly privileged that we're here to take this next step and to help bring condor conservation just that much farther.
Well, I want to say thank you for all that you've done as you move forward in restoring the condor. And I hope we can speak again when we have a little more news on their progress and how they're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I love talking to you today.
That's Tiana Williams-Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department.
The Friday edition is a production of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. Comments made are those of the speaker. We thank the Arcata Playhouse staff and board for their cooperation, and the Lost Coast Outpost for posting the Yurok Tribe's wildlife story. The host, producer, and engineer of this edition has been Joseph Orozco, lead producer. We thank you for listening.